I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. My guest today is Robert Derlett, a professor emeritus at the Medical School of the University of California, Davis, and former chief of emergency medicine at the Davis Medical Center for nearly two decades. Instrumental in starting the residency training program in emergency medicine, Dr. Derlett has published over 100 scientific research articles on such topics as emergency room overcrowding and wilderness medicine. He has lectured extensively, both nationally and internationally, serving as a visiting professor at numerous hospitals worldwide. He has provided care to patients on 6 out of 7 continents. For the last 20 years, including just last week, Dr. Derlett has also conducted water quality field studies in the upper reaches of the High Sierra mountain range in California, testing for Giardia, E. coli, and other microbes commonly associated with gastrointestinal discomfort and illness. In 2016, Dr. Derlett ran for office as the Democratic candidate for California's 4th Congressional District of the U.S. House of Representatives on a progressive platform that, among other things, emphasized consumer rights. He's the author of the book Corporatizing American Healthcare, published earlier this year. So, Dr. Derlett, welcome to Delving In.
Thank you very much.
So, the advantages of capitalism over other economic systems is supposed to be this. Competition and market pressures, supply and demand, yield the best possible products at the lowest possible cost, or they're supposed to. Why are these economic forces not working in the American healthcare system?
Well, I think there's several reasons, and you need to look at the individual segments of the healthcare system we have. For instance, drug prices, pharmacy has moved towards a monopoly business model in which there is no competition. You set the price. Hospitals are consolidating so that there is a monopoly business model among many hospitals and limited choice. Likewise, many physicians are now employed by large Wall Street entities, and there's less choice of who physicians can work for.
So there's a kind of consolidation that's occurring, not just in medicine, of course, but across the board. And I mean, Amazon is famously taking an enormous market share, and they're able to outcompete because of that near monopoly status in many cases. So if there were an application of antitrust laws, do you think that would help to bring down the prices?
No, absolutely. I think antitrust laws, and I think we have to look towards Europe, where they actually move toward setting the prices so that hospitals and physicians know what they're going to get from every patient, and that the prices are negotiated among the all parties so that we don't have some of the outrageous prices that we see here in the United States.
You know, I'm wondering if inelastic demand, I don't know if you're familiar with that phrase, but there's an idea that the certain things can be not bought. Like, for instance, you don't have to get that next bigger TV. But if you're facing a health crisis, you can't go without your insulin, for instance, if you have diabetes. I'm not sure if there are other things that would be considered as inelastic as healthcare, maybe basic transportation, having a certain amount of food, you need a minimum. But it seems to me that's one of the key areas that makes healthcare less amenable to the supply and demand formula.
Well, I think one either needs to have true competition or to have regulation like a regulated utilities. There's the public utilities commissions in many states that regulate the price of electricity. The electrical company still makes a profit and is still successful, but electrical prices are not outrageous, except for, say, what happened in Texas this past year with the deep freeze. Well, let's look at medicine. Historically, medicine was spread out, and let me just give you an example. A town might have 50 primary care physicians. They're all competing for business. They're going to be nice. They're going to provide good care, and they're competing also with the prices. If you're a patient, or some people would say a consumer, you can choose among, say, 50 doctors. If you don't like one, you can choose another. If one charges too much, you can go to a third. If the third office is dirty, you can go to it, choose a fourth. So you consumers and patients, we have this incredible choice, even in the old days, when you know medicine is a necessity. Now look at where consolidation has occurred. Some of these towns or cities, hospitals have basically bought up all the practices. So now instead of being able to choose from 50 different practices with 50 different types of management, you have the hospital umbrella providing one single management, one single set of protocols, and your choice is very limited because most of the physicians in that group who've joined the group will be following the hospital mandates. So again, very little choice. The prices will be all the same. And you can say, well, why did this happen? And I think this is an important thing that's missed in healthcare delivery of primary care in the United States. And that is the facility use fee. When Medicare was first formulated in 1964, 65, hospitals were allowed to charge a facility use fee. Physicians' offices, independent physicians, were not. And let me give you an example of what this has turned out to be, how it has evolved. So let's say a typical visit to a doctor would cost $90, a $90 reimbursement from an insurance company, $90 from Medicare, or $90 if you have no insurance out of your pocket. That $90 going to the independent physician, and maybe there's two or three in a group, has to cover everything. It has to pay for the utilities, light bills, rent, maintenance on the office, equipment, and to pay the staff. And what's left over from that $90 visit goes to the doctor. And now it's very little because of the cost of maintenance of utilities and rent and supplies and staff. Now the hospital gets to collect something that's called a facility use fee. And that facility use fee is not small. It may not be $90. It may be $100. It may be $200. It may be $250. In fact, I've seen facility use fees for hospital visits. This is just a visit to a hospital doctor as high as $300. So this provides hospitals with enormous amount of money where they can entice physicians with higher salaries that they can make compared to being an independent doctor, and basically has really changed the landscape of doctoring in America.
So this idea of a utility use fee, and as you say in your book, it's hard to find another industry that has that, where the consumer is charged directly for the overhead as well as for the service. Was there a law passed to allow that, or just hospitals and group practices? I mean, I guess not group practices, but corporate practices just started doing that.
The facility use fee was allowed in the Medicare legislation and regulations that came through afterwards, and the private insurance companies had followed suit. So if I'm an independent doctor and I have my practice down the street, I hung out my shingle, and I submit a bill to an insurance company, they will pay me my professional fee. But if I say, hey, here's my facility use fee, they refuse to pay. In fact, they may refuse to pay my professional fee because they might think that visit is unnecessary. That has happened. But hospitals have been able to get away with this. And I think in part because their strong ability to lobby Congress and basically have been able to sequester large sums of the healthcare dollar. Where really the rubber hits the road is in emergency departments, where facility use fees can be as low as $1,000, but can be as high as $10,000. And I've talked to patients who've complained where they've come into busy emergency departments. They've laid on gurneys in the hallway, and they're charged for everything from every Band-Aid to IV tubing to intravenous fluid to medications. And then on top of everything, get a facility use fee. I think in the old days, before hospitals consolidated, that everything was either to be included in the facility use fee or to be billed individually. And now, in some respects, hospitals are double dipping.
Yeah, I've noticed that in my own colonoscopies that there's a pretty hefty copay, even though I supposedly have good insurance. And in addition to this, the colonoscopy itself, there's also the utility use fee, which I first time I saw it, I was sort of my jaw dropped, and it was equally large number. So I know exactly what you're talking about. No, as emergency medicine specialist, you've seen up front, I mean, some of the biggest source of increases in medical costs. I'm wondering, did your feeling about national healthcare change over the years? Because this is something that I asked my cousin a couple of weeks ago, who I had on the show, who's a retired nephrologist and nephrology professor from Cleveland, that he, like many other physicians, let's say 30 years ago, was very much against national healthcare and was worried about not so much the loss of income, but the loss of autonomy. And I was wondering, did you go through that transformation as well?
Yes, and it occurred after multiple visits to Western Europe as a visiting professor. And I think, you know, Americans think that the Europeans have one system, you know, a single payer system, sort of like in Great Britain, where the government employs doctors, the government owns most all the hospitals and mandates different types of protocols. Each country in Europe has a different system. And I think Holland or the Netherlands has one of the closest emulating the United States, where they have multiple insurance companies who insure all the citizens and who, you know, get their revenue not only from personal premiums, but also government contributions. But the key is it's looked at like a utility, and prices are controlled. The cost of hospitalization is controlled. The cost of a doctor visit, the cost of drugs, so that no one's going to rip off the patients. And we really need some type of cost controls. And we have it already. The system is here. We have Medicare. Medicare has set prices for hospitals, set prices for visits. And Medicare has gone out and surveyed different areas so that those prices are fair, in contrast to Medicaid, which pays too little in most states.
So you say the Medicare prices are adjusted for location?
Yes, they are. So that in high labor markets, in obviously, for example, New York City, the cost of a hospital is much higher than, say, in a smaller rural area. So they will pay more in areas that have high cost to deliver care, which I think is in contrast to Medicaid.
Was it your impression that in the European systems, the ones that used multiple, I guess, subcontractors, I guess you could say, you know, that the prices were fixed, but did it lend itself to a certain amount of competition, you know, not necessarily in the cost area, because they all were getting the same reimbursements, but in the type of care? I mean, were they competing for numbers of patients by trying to outdo the other company?
Well, I think not so much as companies, but doctors. You can still choose your doctor.
Okay.
And if you want one doctor, you can go to another doctor. The regulations also affect the insurance companies in terms of how much they can pay, how much they can charge, how much they can keep for their overhead. And look at our insurance companies. See, what insurance companies keep in this country is 20% for the very large health plans to up to 25% in the smaller health plans. And that's after the Affordable Care Act, which I'll refer to as Obamacare, came into place. It says, hey, you really can't keep more than 20%. Compare that to the overhead of Medicare, which is estimated at 3 to 4%, and the overhead of many insurance companies in Western Europe, which is estimated at 3 to 4%.
So where do doctor salaries come in here in terms of the healthcare cost? I mean, I know that it's may not be the very largest of the costs, but it's still substantial. I've read recently that the average American doctor is paid about double the highest paid doctors in Europe, which are in Germany, and about three times the salaries in France, and about even more than that compared to the doctors in Spain. And it seems to me that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that American doctors have been willing to go along with some of these changes, even loss of autonomy, in order to keep the salaries stable, because they would have fallen otherwise. And I don't know, is that a misperception, or what do you think?
No, I think you're correct. My colleagues will not like what I say about doctors' salaries, but they have really gone up tremendously in the past 10 years, even though the prediction would be they would might fall. In part, they've gone up, like I said, because doctors have been drawn away from independent practice to go work for the hospital. And the hospital can pay them more, and it may not be a direct payment because in some states, the hospital cannot employ doctors, so there's a separate physician entity. But the revenue through the facility use fee does get back to support doctors' salaries, to support doctors' retirement, education, vacation, et cetera. And yes, it's higher than in Europe. And I think many of the physicians will go along with working on a computer that's frustrating because they get a high salary.
Yeah, I've noticed that happening even here in Las Cruces, that this consolidation process, the local hospitals are buying up practices left and right. I chose a doctor who's not affiliated with one of the hospitals as an independent practice, solo practice, but that's very, very rare. I mean, you see it sometimes in some of the older doctors, that my particular doctor is middle-aged. But my previous doctor I had switched from, who also was independent, because he didn't take my insurance, and so I had to, he was out of network. But then since I've left him, he's left he joined his practice to one of the local hospitals. And I think part of that for him is he's getting close to retirement age or beyond, and maybe doesn't want the hassle of trying to sell his practice in the current market. I mean, who's going to buy it if everything's getting consolidated? So this way he sells it to the big entity. And I'm just speculating here. I haven't talked to him about it. So there's another big topic, and that's the secrecy around pricing. Maybe secrecy's too blatant a word. Maybe it should be non-published, you know, but it's hard to find what things are going to cost, especially large kind of items like surgeries or other procedures.
This is goes back to what you said at the beginning. In a true free market capitalistic system, prices should be posted and you should be able to choose. As you walk into the hospital, you should have a price list, just like you in a supermarket. You see the prices posted on the wall. You see the prices on every item. And it is incredible that we've developed a system where we have the secret prices. As one person told me, it's like, hey, going to a store, picking up a gallon of milk, and when you check out, they say, we'll send you a bill in 1 to 2 months. And then you get the bill for your gallon of milk, and whoa, it's $100. Now, you probably wouldn't pick up that gallon of milk if you knew it was $100. So you can see there's a sneaky model. Even the Trump administration in its waning days attempted to have hospitals, in fact, made a rule that they need to post their secret deals that they do with the insurance companies so everybody knows what everybody's paying. And hospitals, according to the Wall Street Journal, have not complied. I'm one for, we really need to post the prices. If you walk into a physician's office, even if it's a hospital corporation office, there's prices posted. A minimum visit, medium visit, maximum visit, prices for vaccinations, prices for tests. We don't have that. And the question is, why not? It's because Congress has not stepped up to the plate. It's because the intense lobbying by the healthcare industry is preventing this from happening. And lobby your congressman as an individual to say, hey, we need to post prices.
We were talking about the lack of posting of prices, the lack of transparency of knowing what things are going to cost. It used to be transparent if you had insurance. I mean, there were postings in the insurance policy that an office visit would cost so much. And I remember when I first got insurance through the public schools here, the copay was, I don't know, I think $6 for an office visit, and the copay for hospitalization was $100 and no additional cost. That was it, $100. And that's changed so vastly that even if you have insurance, even if you have what's considered good insurance, a good Blue Cross Blue Shield policy, for instance, you just have no idea whether you're going to how much money you're going to have to fork out for various things. It's become a feeling of, am I insured or not insured?
So you brought up several excellent points. And over the last 10 years, insurance companies have evolved to have a number of platforms. In some cases, patients have deductibles as high as $8,000 before their insurance kicked in. Now, yes, they might get three primary care visits free, so to speak, per year. But I've had patients come up to me and say, "Doc, what kind of insurance is this? I have to pay $8,000 out of my pocket before I can get certain x-rays, before I can see a specialist, before I can get medications, et cetera." And I think this has really brought healthcare expenses into the spotlight, you know, in the past several years, probably the more than the past several years, as the Obamacare is called the Affordable Care Act to try to make healthcare affordable to everyone, and it has not.
Maybe it was misnamed. I'm not sure what a more accurate name would be. Would be in the direction of an affordable healthcare.
The intent was affordable healthcare, but if you watch the PBS special Obama's Dilemma or Obama's Choice, you can see that the original intent of the Affordable Care Act was really warped by the lobbying that went on in Washington, especially by the insurance industry, that basically killed the public option. In other words, people could opt for something like Medicare, but the insurance company obviously would not be involved in that. So unfortunately, it's back to politics, where the lobbyists in Washington, where the campaign contributions have an enormous impact on shaping healthcare to the average American. And the bottom line is, all these lobbyists, all these healthcare companies that contribute to political campaigns, the bottom line result is healthcare that costs twice as much as in Europe. And in Europe, where there's free choice and the cost to society is half. Why is this? Congress has let this happen, and it has provided enormous profits to so many segments of the healthcare industry.
Right. And another example would be the Medicare Part D under the second George Bush, that my understanding is that the pharmaceutical companies successfully prevented the government from negotiating drug prices. So it turned out to be a windfall for the drug companies.
Absolutely. And not only that, a lot of people don't realize that the George Bush Act in 2003 for Medicare Part D basically privatized Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D is handled by private companies. And you sign up with a company and they decide what's on the formulary, what you can get and what you can't get.
Yeah, so much for free market. It's the market is really determined from the supply side, it seems to me. I also wanted to bring up another aspect of lack of transparency. Like we talked about, well, if prices were posted, if that was mandated by Congress, that would go a long way toward restoring some supply and demand, some competition. But part of the problem is that medical care is complicated, and not everyone is really capable of understanding the nuances of what to do. So it's very different than, let's say, shopping for the latest and high-definition television. You go to the display and you see which one you like, and you choose it based on what it looks like. And it's pretty, that's, you know, literally transparent. But with healthcare, I mean, sometimes the options are very confusing, require a high level of sophistication to be able to choose. So how can supply and demand work in that situation?
Right. We don't have openness of prices, no transparency. Now, in all fairness, some states have required that hospitals post on the internet their 20 or 25 most common charges. In reality, it's hard to find these. When you do, they're sometimes coded. The federal government did the same. It's very difficult. I found one hospital in California where they listed all their prices. There were thousands of pages. And you know what? It was all in code. I can understand some of the codes of the doctor that I use commonly, but it's like if you're an individual consumer, it's impossible. And yet they can say, well, we posted our prices. Prices should be done in simple layman terms, such as if you're going to an emergency room, sew up a cut on your finger, evaluate you for chest pain, evaluate you for abdominal pain. Simple things that people understand and can see what the price is. And there is a notion in Europe of something called diagnostic-related group charges. These are called DRGs, and this is actually used by Medicare for hospitalized patients. So in other words, if you go to a hospital with pneumonia, the hospital can only charge a pneumonia charge. They can't nickel and dime for every Band-Aid, every shot, every meal, et cetera. And I've seen some of these DRGs and compared them to prices in America. And let me give you an example. To have an artificial hip put in, which is a very common procedure, patient gets a new hip. I've seen the list price in hospitals in California at as high as $100,000. Now, wow, $100,000. I've seen the DRG in Finland, $10,000. Now, why can they do it for $10,000 and we charge $100,000? Well, $100,000 is the retail price. In reality, it probably cost our hospital $20,000-$25,000 to do it. So a lot of profit. Now, not every insurance company is going to pay the $100,000. Many insurance companies are going to have a contract, quote, in-network, and pay $40,000-$50,000. Medicare, from what I can determine, pays about $30,000. So the hospital still makes a profit with Medicare. Now, I've heard that in California, some union plans are negotiating with hospitals to have it done for $20,000-$25,000. So we're getting closer to this, I'll say, Finland model of $10,000. Now, what do they do differently in Finland? In Finland, the hospital director is given the money by the government for each DRG procedure or hospitalization. So the hospital director gets $10,000 for the hip and X thousand for all these other procedures. How do they figure out how to do it? Well, one thing, they run their hospitals 24/7. Their hospitals don't shut down on Saturday and Sunday. They work around the clock, maximal efficiency. They don't have all these committee meetings. Like in the United States, we have incredible compliance meetings. We have sometimes overregulation and overkill with some of these requirements. Even in the emergency room, I'm filling out a patient visit, and I have to ask these questions totally unrelated to an emergency department visit. How often do you eat pizza every week? Because that's supposed to be, hey, healthcare, you know, we want to make sure your healthcare is good. Geez, you know, I'm here to sew up the cut you have on your hand, not to asking you about your immunization records, other than tetanus. Obviously, we ask that in the ER. Other than, do you brush your teeth? Do you floss your teeth? Do you smoke? Do you not smoke? So all these things have been thrown in, which really frontline providers don't need to ask unless it's relevant. So we, in some respect, have made our system inefficient. And I think if you look at my book, my preface is talking about eating at a restaurant in the United States versus ordering the same food in a bureaucratic country. In this case, it was Belarus, where it was just an incredible bureaucratic snag. And now if we're on to bureaucracy for a moment, hospitals as well as clinics have to argue and argue to get an insurance company to pay. And they just refuse to pay because the T's are not crossed on your note or the I's are not dotted. Every excuse not to pay. So one has to go through huge time-consuming telephone calls back and forth with the insurance company to get paid. And while I'm the insurance companies, they regulate who gets to see specialists, who gets to get certain type of imaging, such as MRIs. Not all, but too many. And as an example, when I did primary care during my emeritus status, which was absolutely incredible, I just got to be frontline, see patients, take care of them. I really, really enjoyed it. Did not enjoy entering things into the computer. If I wanted an MRI, most insurance companies would require the medical assistant to go online and to take this little test of multiple choice. You know, why does the patient really need an MRI of their back? And go through all of this. It was just this game that they were playing. Where as the doctor, if I saw somebody who had a herniated disc, who basically a ruptured disc in their back, and I knew really was in severe pain by exam, hey, let's get an MRI. Let's not have to spend a week hassling with the insurance companies. The same with referring up to specialists. Very difficult. The insurance companies do not want, many insurance companies do not want their patients seen, and it is a back and forth argument. Now, insurance companies, many of them, will say, well, you can appeal. Well, let me tell you what the appeal process is for a primary care doctor. You get on the phone and you spend an hour trying to get through to the insurance physician who can mediate the appeal. And almost uniformly, they're going to refuse. And what I find incredibly insulting, they've never examined the patient. They've never seen the patient. And yet they're making a decision on patient care by saying, you can't have an MRI on that patient.
Dr. Durlett, how does the idea persist among such a large swath of the population that we have the best medical care? Maybe it has these encumbrances, maybe the cost is higher, but we have the most innovative, the most cutting-edge healthcare in the world, or so the thought goes. I mean, what is supporting that notion?
Well, if you have good insurance, we have outstanding surgeons, outstanding specialists, but they also do in Europe. The issue in the United States is access. And even though we have outstanding care, whether it be cancer or innovative surgery, or vascular surgery, heart surgery, they also have the same procedures in Europe. Access in Europe is better compared to the United States. For example, if you're on Medicaid, which is a federal insurance program for low-income people, first of all, you may not have access to most physicians because many physicians do not take Medicaid because the reimbursement is so low. And you may therefore end up using emergency departments for your care. By the time you reach the emergency department, your condition may be worse. Example, no insulin and coming in with diabetic ketoacidosis. So we have this fragmented system where if you have outstanding insurance or money, you can access good care. If you do not, your care is worse than Europe.
When you were running for office in 2016, I know that you didn't win, and you were running in a highly Republican district. I read that that district only elected, I think, a Democratic senator twice in recent years. It was Feinstein and Harris, Kamala Harris.
Actually, I was running for Congress, and it was Tom McClintock who.
Right. I know you're running for Congress, but even among senators, that district voted usually for the Republican, and certainly for Congress even more so. So, what approach did you take? I mean, I imagine you knew that you're facing an uphill battle. And were you talking about healthcare primarily? I know that you had a wider platform than that, but what kind of responses did you get from potential constituents?
Well, people were very interested in the cost of healthcare and interested, as I mentioned earlier on, because insurance was paying less, copays were higher, deductibles were higher, the in-network, out-of-network problem has become worse. And what that has resulted in is limited choice. I think in listening to so many people at town halls, they're willing to pay reasonable prices, but they also want choice. They want freedom to go to the specialist they want to go to the hospital they want to, and to go to the doctor they want to. Let me give you an example we'll get back to insurance companies. Too many insurance companies have limited panels of doctors who are in their network. So if, say, we'll go back to that town of 50 doctors who are providing primary care, not the specialists, you would say, well, there's 50 doctors in this town. I should be able to choose from 50 doctors. And the insurance company says, well, no, there are only 5 of the 50 who are in network. It's like, but you still have 5 to choose from. All those 5 doctors, and they're all full. So you have to go to the next town to get care. What kind of system is that?
Did you have a feeling that you were able to convince people to change their minds about a national healthcare system? I mean, an improvement over the Obamacare?
Well, I think, unfortunately, too many are basically told that the healthcare in Europe is all the English system, where the government owns the hospitals and pays most of the doctors. And in an era where people are looking at, well, do we want big government? Do we want small government? Do we really want the government owning everything? In fact, unfortunately, too many people don't have all the facts, and the facts are in other European countries. It's a different system with better choices. Now, the other thing you hear about is that, well, if I need surgery, it's going to be delayed. And in the U.S., I could just go in tomorrow into the hospital and get it. Well, if you're paying cash, I guess you could. But I can tell you, so many of my patients needed surgeries, whether it be a knee replacement, a hip replacement, a shoulder replacement, elective abdominal surgery. And the insurance company throws up roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. The delays are so long, I even can joke to a couple of patients, well, maybe you should go to Europe to get your operation. It can be done quicker. But it's just this misinformation people have that this system is worse outside the United States when, in fact, it's better.
Let's spend the rest of the hour talking about your specialty area, emergency medicine. I understand that you were part of the effort to turn emergency medicine into an actual specialty in medicine. And so you're probably one of the best equipped people to talk about how the pricing of emergency medicine has skyrocketed in recent decades. So what would be some of the maybe lesser known aspects of why and how those costs have escalated?
So before I get to cost, let me just trace a little of the history of emergency medicine. Back in the late 70s, early 1980s, many emergency departments, smaller ones, were not staffed by physicians. The patients would come in and the nurse would call the patient's primary care doctor or general practitioner to come in and, you know, solve the problem. As emergency departments got busier, emergency departments were staffed initially by what we call moonlighters, people who had various specialties, who really had no training in emergency medicine to take care of patients with undiagnosed injuries and illnesses. My goal in the late 1980s, early 1990s, was to put a trained emergency physician in every Northern California emergency department. And with that goal, we started a training program. What has evolved with all of this in America is that people with less access to care, who don't have primary care physicians because they choose not to, will come to emergency departments, making the demand for care greater. Hospitals have recognized this as a monopoly cash cow, where they can just set any price they want. I mean, who looks at the price? Do you look at a price list when you go to the emergency department?
Usually it's not the first thing on your mind.
What you do is you go and you think it'll be a fair price, not expecting a $5,000 facility use fee by the hospital. So hospitals have actually raised their prices and they'll say, well, we have to do that because some people don't pay at all. And it's because of to counterbalance the uncompensated care. Well, I think they've overbalanced by their very high charges. And in fact, in some cases, if you have a lab test drawn in the emergency department, your charge will be higher than had that test been done in the hospital. So isn't that amazing? Just because it's drawn in the emergency department, a simple blood test or an x-ray will be higher because it's, quote, done through the emergency department. Now, what's also happened in emergency medicine is individual hospitals, which used to have individual small groups of doctors staffing their emergency departments, have been bought out by national groups, so that very close to 50% of docs in emergency rooms work for a Wall Street or private equity firm. Many of these firms have raised the professional fees. So you're paying a professional fee plus the hospital fee plus all the fees related to medications, x-rays, when you go into the emergency department. I mean, you can see you get a huge bill. So the physicians employed by many Wall Street companies, they get a salary, they can get a bonus, but Wall Street also takes their cut. And there's been a couple of exposés in national media, such as the New York Times, showing that these companies raise the prices and pay the docs the same and keep the difference. So part of the corporatization is these companies are basically skimming money for their profit. It has also brought another problem in that physicians have to keep quiet and can't complain. Many of these national groups will fire a physician for complaining because they're worried they're going to lose the contract of supplying the hospital with physicians. And I think one of the best known of this occurred last spring when we had the COVID epidemic begin, and an emergency physician in Washington State complained that the hospital was not COVID ready, and he was fired, made national headlines.
Could you talk also about the status of observation, of a patient as an observation rather than being designated as inpatient? This is something that I found really astounding that I read in your book.
When a patient is admitted to the hospital, they're automatically thrown into a different type of payment system, such as the DRG, diagnostic related groups, and which may mean, hey, the hospital can only collect a overall fee for the hospitalization, or it goes into a negotiated fee with various insurance companies. If you're an observation status, basically every Band-Aid, your nickel and dime, everything, facility use fee, every Band-Aid, every aspirin, so to speak, you're charged for, which is more profitable.
You gave an example of someone sticking their head in and saying, how are you doing? And it turned out to be some specialist, and then they billed like a full evaluation fee for that.
Now we're getting to the issue of inpatients who are hospitalized. And not too long ago, if you were hospitalized, your primary care doctor, your general practitioner would come in and take care of you in consultation as needed with specialists. Docs are so busy on the front line that it's difficult to do both inpatient and outpatient medicine, unless say you're a surgeon who has an outpatient clinic and then who comes in and does surgery and takes care of patients. So many patients in hospitals are cared for by hospitalists, and many hospitalists are employed by Wall Street corporations, and they're driven to take care of some very complex patients, but also bill very high. So they may make rounds and spend minimal time with a patient, quote, poking their head in the door, and charging an enormous professional fee for that, much of which goes to Wall Street.
And getting back to the observation status, so the first, couple of days can be called observation rather than inpatient, even though it's in the hospital? Is that right?
I'm not sure what the cutoff in the length is, but it used to be if it was after midnight, then you had to make a decision, either be it you're admitted or not admitted. And now there's a longer time period, but I can't tell you exactly what that period is.
And then as it turns out that if you're only in for the observational period, then it makes you ineligible to go to rehab because you have to become from inpatient for certain procedures, certain diagnostic categories.
Medicare has these rules, some of which are antiquated. In the old days, it was much easier to get patients into the hospital. And Medicare thought, well, if you really needed rehab, you must have been hospitalized. So yes, you're correct.
Right. And even though you're in the hospital, it doesn't count because it's called observation.
Right. Well, this is actually back to the way things were framed in 1964 with Medicare. Medicare Part A was hospitalization. Medicare Part B was outpatient, quote, the doctor's office. And in those days, remember, the doctor's office could do x-rays. They could dispense you medication. They could provide intravenous treatments as needed. Emergency departments were more of a triage area where if you were sick, you were admitted. If you weren't sick, you were, you know, put a cast on or a splint or Band-Aid and sent home. Now, emergency departments have become hospitals within hospitals. And as a result, the fees are high. And I think it really emergency care should be provided under Part A of Medicare.
Yeah, the irony is I think the people who may be least afraid to go to the hospital are people with Medicaid because they know they can't be charged. And the people with private insurance, it's a terrifying prospect because you don't know what that bill is going to be. It's probably going to be very, very high, almost no matter what. And there isn't informed consent about, you know, do you want this procedure or do you not want this procedure? I mean, it's all just sort of done. I mean, within reason. I mean, of course, if it's a surgery, that there has to be permission. But all these, it seems to me there's an awful lot that's done without an informed consent saying, you know, if we do this, you'll have to pay that. I mean, it's just all these surprises.
To put yourself in the shoes of a hospital CEO, you know, if someone's coming along saying, advocating, well, we really need to have the maximum price be the Medicare price for hospitalization, whether it's for pneumonia or auto accident or a hip replacement. Well, what about the payers that don't pay well or don't pay at all? So Medicaid would have to pay the same prices that Medicare does. And what about the patients who come into the emergency room who have no money at all? Well, somebody needs to pay for that. So in any type of reform, the things need to average out. So all the low pays and no pays need to be at a certain bar, certain level, so that the high bar can be lowered and we could just have one set price.
One of the things that surprised me in reading your book is about some of the reasons for the shortage of doctors. I had thought that the AMA was deliberately keeping the numbers down somehow by reducing the residencies in order to keep the salaries higher. But in your book, you talk about the residencies being paid for by the federal government somehow, I guess through some kind of Medicare arrangement. And so the hospitals are not actually paying for their residents, the government is. And for whatever reason, it was really surprising to me that hospitals wouldn't be willing to pay extra for more residents than the government would pay, given how low the salary is for a resident for the number of hours they work. So that was really surprising.
This gets back to the complexity of healthcare that I describe in my book, and I'll get to you. Now, my book, Corporatizing American Healthcare, it's only 200 pages, and it could easily be 1,000 pages. I wrote it as 200 pages in order to make it readable for students. And as you may have noticed in the back, there's an exam that tries to highlight the points, 50 question exam. I also have a summary a conclusion that kind of gives the high points of each chapter. It's not a comprehensive book. It can't be, but it was intended to be readable by students in their busy lives. And I've seen students get a book that's 1,000 pages and unable to be read or too complex. So this is to try to be simple. So I'll be trying to be simple in my answer about residencies. So there are certain specialties, and my understanding is neurosurgery has been accused of this, of trying to limit the number of residency slots. May not be that simple. Because in order to have a residency program, you have to go through so many different complex teaching requirements. It's not easy to have a residency. And because it's not easy to have a residency and because of so much teaching is involved, the federal government does subsidize the hospitals that have residencies. And in some respects, this has been referred to as cheap labor because they work extra long hours. It doesn't cost the hospital a lot because they get a reimbursement from the federal government. But on the other hand, there are professors and doctors who have to have, quote, time off to teach these residents. And in the past, and here again, we get into many of the laws, many of the regulations were set up for things in the past. In the past, a newly minted physician might follow a experienced physician around. The newly minted physician would be an intern and basically learn on the spot, put all their book learning of medical school to use by basically see one, do one, teach one, following. Well, now residencies become so complex where they have teaching curricula. In emergency medicine, when we applied in the early 1990s, our curriculum was 500 pages. It's now well over 1,000. Residents have to be tracked as to every procedure they do, what type of patients they see. Again, it's just bureaucracy that has grown so tremendous that some people say, wait a minute, residency programs are great, but it's not all as much free labor as you think.
Well, this might be the last question. I'm curious if you would think that doctors have an ethical responsibility to warn their patients about costs and to take the patient's cost into account. For instance, even something as simple as prescribing a medication to make sure that the medication is covered by the patient's health plan, for instance, and that's not going to cost them $1,000 a month, but also telling them about the relative cost of different ways of handling a certain problem. I mean, is that part of, I don't imagine it's part of medical school, but should it be part of a doctor's ethical responsibility as the provider?
You bring up a very important issue. We really do not teach cost as much as we should in medical schools. We really do not teach cost in residency programs. Basically, the mantra is do whatever is necessary, whatever is best, without really weighing the cost to it, without really discussing this with the patient, throwing medications at them, throwing procedures without really informed consent as much as we should. Certainly, obviously, if you're going to have a major operation on your abdomen, there's informed consent about risk. But, you know, there's not informed discussion about, hey, if there's a complication, here's how much it's going to cost you. Let me give you an example in our last minute of a patient I saw in my practice who came in with abdominal pain and wanted to know if he had appendicitis. And I examined him, I examined his belly, I examined him all over carefully, and this was a $90 visit. I says, I can assure you with 95% confidence that you do not have appendicitis. 95%, but not 100%. I said, if you want 100%, or I would say 99% confidence that you do not have appendicitis, you have to go to the emergency department in the nearest town, and that's going to cost you not $90, but $9,000, because they're going to do a CT scan. They're going to do all these laboratory tests. So I said, the bottom line here for you to decide, and I think this is so important, the patient needs to decide. You can decide on the $90 answer, which is my answer, for 95% confidence, or you can pay $9,000, because this guy was paying out of his pocket, $9,000 for the 99% answer.
So what was his response?
He says, Doc, I'll take the $90 answer.
And see if the pain goes away.
And he didn't mind. I called him a few days later. That's the beauty of, you know, a good primary care doctor. You didn't call your patient. You call him. I called him a few days later, says, how you doing? He says, I'm doing fine.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I wonder if there have been any studies about the effect of surprise medical bills on the stress level and physical health symptoms of patients. You know, because it's not completely divorced from health status. I mean, it's an enormous stress if it's going to cause potential bankruptcy, for instance. I mean, that's got to be among the worst stresses possible in a person's life.
I agree with you 100%, and it's sad that it's only the mainstream media, such as the New York Times, Washington Post, Kaiser Health News who are doing this. And I will put a plug in for Kaiser Health News. They have really been on top of some of the healthcare costs. And I would recommend you go to their website and take a look at Bill of the Month because it'll startle you in terms of healthcare costs.
Right. Can you top this? All right. Well, I think that we're coming to the end of our interview, and I really appreciated meeting with you. You're very, very knowledgeable on the subject, really firsthand information. Dr. Robert Derlett, the professor emeritus at the Medical School of the University of California, Davis, former chief of emergency medicine at the Davis Medical Center, and also the candidate for the 4th Congressional District in California in 2016, and the author of the recent book, Corporatizing American Healthcare. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. And I'll say we talked for 1 hour. We could talk for 10 hours and still not cover this in the depth that is necessary.
I agree with you, and I appreciate the 1 hour.
Thank you.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.